Good morning, everyone. Some of you asked me earlier on if I thought we had a personal angel. And when the lights came back on so I could see, I thought, I must have one. I noticed the rest of you came up with your little technology items. And for all of you that have all this negative about technology, there are some times where it's really nice to have, isn't it? I can remember one time back at Livonia when all the lights went out in Detroit, and those of us that had laptops, they called on us to do readings and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, wasn't so bad then. Anyways, you know, it's funny, but you look at issues like that in life, and you know, you plan a weekend like this, and you think you have everything all going. And I noticed last night Nate was laid over on the couch in the evening, and he was like really taking it easy because everything was like falling into place, and you think everything is okay, and then all of a sudden the power goes out, and it's like, you know, things like that happen in the middle of our lives. And we can go home, you know, this week, and we can set out like you decide. You have your list ready to go, and I'm going to try this, and I'm going to try this. And you get home, then all of a sudden God throws a curveball at you, and it's something you hadn't expected. And we can so easily get sidetracked from where we were headed if we're not careful. And we do have to be careful, because God will test us and find out if we really are committed. And so things can happen. You get home and you find out, oh, somebody gets sick, or you find out that somebody had an accident, or you find out whatever it is that's in your family, so your ecclesias. And it can be very easy to get distracted, and you lose track of like all the things that we talked about this weekend, of things that we were committed to try to go home and do. But that's God's way of helping us understand in the end that really it's not about us. And, you know, because sometimes we get home and say, I'm going to go home and I'm going to do this and I'm going to try this. And it's all about what I'm going to do. And God's trying to remind us that it really isn't about what we are going to do. It's about asking for God's help to go home this week and apply these things in our lives, and to give us the wisdom to know how to do it with our wives and our kids and our ecclesias. And I find sometimes in the Bible, it's fun to look at models about how to accomplish those things. I would thought, you know, in terms of like men's weekends for your future, it's fun to like not only talk about sometimes the practical things like we did this weekend, but it would also be fun to look at biblical models about, well, how did people solve ecclesial problems? How did people work with their families? And you look back in the lives of the patriarchs, or you look in some of the biblical models that are there of solving ecclesial problems. Like, what happened when they heard the rumors about the 2.5 tribes building that altar up on the western side of the Jordan? And, you know, immediately they wanted to go kill them all. And, you know, Phinehas gets a group together and said, wait a minute, let's go talk to them first and find out why. There are some real good Bible models about how to solve problems. And like the Jerusalem Conference in Acts 15 is like that as well. So that might be like something you could do at some point where you look at, you know, and when we're doing our readings, this is what we should be doing, is looking for solutions on Bible stories about what has God left behind for us about models to solve these issues and how to tackle those problems. And I think in the story of Ezra, when you're reading through the book of Ezra, you find some really good models about how to implement some of these things in ecclesial life. And what I like about the story of Ezra is that it's a time period in history, in Israel's history at least, where there's no open manifestation of the Spirit, where an angel doesn't just show up and talk to Ezra or talk to Zerubbabel and Joshua. What you have are two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, who are talking to the people. But it really is more like today. And when it talks about in those early chapters we read this week about God stirring up the spirit of Cyrus to make his decree, or God stirring up the spirits of the people to give, or he stirs up the spirits of Joshua and Zerubbabel to lead those people back. This is what God's doing with us this weekend. He's stirring up the spirits that we have to go home and try to implement some of these things. And he does that through ways like this, of having men's weekends, and, you know, things come to us in the Word, and we talk with one another, and we get some good ideas. But the book of Ezra is really very similar to our time period. Here they come back, and they start working on the temple. They start building it, as we looked at this week. They lay the foundations. Well, first of all, they built the altar, like we looked at in the readings the other day. And they built the altar, and they were going to like start the service to God and get their lives back together. And then they start laying the foundations of the temple in chapter 3. And there is a real warning for us in the readings just yesterday when they were working on the foundation of the temple. If you had been alive at that time, and you had been alive back before, and you had actually been a part of Solomon's temple, And you had seen it before Nebuchadnezzar had come in and just burned the temple and they stripped the gold and took it all off. And you remembered what it was like back then. And now you watch the new generation building this temple and they don't have all those resources, all those logs from Tyre and Sidon that got sent down and shipped down, all those cedars that were there and all the gold that was available that David and Solomon, you know, had access to. And now the younger generation is working on this temple. And they lay the foundation of the temple and they get an idea about what this is going to look like. And the younger people are all excited. Did you notice that at the end of Ezra 3? It talked about how the builders, when they laid the foundation of the temple, that they stood there and they're praising the Lord in verse 10 with the symbols and, you know, according to the ordinance of David, the king of Israel. So they're following David's rules. They sang responsively like that and they praise God, giving thanks to him. And then there's this great shout when they praise the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and the Levites and the heads of the fathers' houses who were old men, they'd seen the first temple. They wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes, yet many people shouted for joy. And I think it's a good warning to those of us that are older when we go home to our families and our ecclesias that we have to be careful with the next generation coming up. We can be very negative sometimes of looking at projects that they organize. So like the younger people organize a seminar or they organize a witnessing activity. And we look at that and we say, well, wow, that wasn't as good as we used to do. And we can become sort of negative about their work. And in this case, as you're going through this story, you're going to find out this isn't the only time this comes up. This spirit of negativism, going back to ecclesial life, of putting a damper on the effects of this project, over the next 15 years, this wore the people down. So there were the Samaritans certainly causing the trouble that we've been reading about from the outside. But internally, there were brethren and sisters who were wearing the people down and discouraging them. Yeah, this really isn't all that good. It's not like the old one we used to have. And they did discourage the people. So you find out that both Haggai and Zechariah, they both reference this issue about do not despise the day of small things. Because we have to understand that the angels are giving us the resources that we have available today. They're the ones who have provided this and the opportunity to build. And what amazed me about this story as you're going through it is that of all the people who stir them up, as you're going through this and you find out over the next 15 years they get worn out, they're not so interested, the Samaritans cause all that trouble in chapter 4 where they write the king, and then finally, God gives them what some of the people wanted. They didn't want to work on the temple anymore. They really didn't want to do God's work. And so God raises up an imposter in the Persian Empire at this point. They call him this pseudo-Smyrtus fellow who claimed to be the brother of the previous king, Cambyses, who was the son of Cyrus. And this imposter comes along, and some of the historians think he actually killed Cambyses at this point, had him poisoned, and he tries to take over the kingdom, and he's spooked out because he realizes he doesn't really belong there, and so the angels raise this man up for just 7 months or so, and during that period, he's the one who gets the letter, as you read in chapter 4 yesterday, and he's spooked out, well, these people are going to rebel, they're going to cause all trouble in the kingdom, I better send the army down there and make them stop building this temple, and so they do, you know, and the temple work stops at this period. And then this guy is pulled off the scene in just a few months. He didn't last very long when they realized he was an imposter. And then you have Darius comes along, Darius Hystaspes, who comes along in chapter 5. And so what God did at this point is he pulled away from the community what they had thought they had until they appreciated it and then got back to work. And so they did. He stirs up the spirits of the people by sending them two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to get them working again. And you look back through the history, how did he really get them going? How did he encourage these people to get working? So he sends them Haggai. And you're reading through Haggai's prophecy. You know what Haggai does. He comes in. Most people figure he was probably an older prophet. And he comes in and he arrives at people. He said, look, when you went home and worked on your houses over the last couple of months and years, and you sort of slacked off on God's work, how did you really fare? Consider how you fared over the last few years. Your Bible says, consider your ways. It's some of the modern versions they put in there. Consider how you fared over the last few years. Did this really work out to your advantage? You went out and you thought you were going to spend all this time making more money and building up your bigger barns, and God sent inflation into the land, and you put the money in your pockets and it fell right through because God was in control. You know, and you went home and you paneled your houses, Haggai said. You know, is that really what you should be doing when God's house lies in disarray? So don't despise the day of small things, Haggai says. Don't despise it because God doesn't. He wants you to get involved, do the work you can with the resources that you have, and he doesn't expect the impossible out of us. He only expects us to do our part. That's all we have to do. So then Zechariah comes along, and most people figure Zechariah was probably a younger prophet. He's probably a younger man. And Zechariah, in one night, he receives the seven night visions. And you look back over the seven night visions and wonder, well, how did that stir the people up? What did Zechariah bring to them that next morning when he would have come to the people and he said, oh, you should have seen what I saw last night. You should have seen what I saw. These angels were riding back on horses. And they came back to this man, Zechariah chapter 1, who's underneath the mulberry tree there. And he's riding on the horses. And they come back and they say, we've been through the whole earth and we brought the earth back under control. We did our job, you know. And then that angel says to another angel, he says to God, well, how long are you going to wait until you choose Jerusalem again? How long are you going to wait to get this house finished? And Zechariah would come in and say, look at all these things I saw. Here's an angel standing there, and there's Joshua, and there's the Satan opposing him. And, you know, the Satan tries to stop the work, and the angel's there standing there for Joshua and says, the Lord rebuke you. Then God promises to get this temple done, this finished, in the days of Joshua, in chapter 3, and Zechariah 4 is in the days of Zerubbabel. In fact, he sees in Zechariah chapter 3, he sees a stone sitting there, and it would have been the stone that the builders had probably picked along the way when they were building the foundations. And what they would do when they would build buildings in those days is they would take a stone that they thought would be the best one in the end to be the last stone, called the capstone, that would sit up there on top. And they would finally put that one in place, and it would hold the weight of the whole building. They called it the capstone. Some of our modern versions actually have that in Zechariah chapter 4. So this stone is sitting over there waiting to go up. And it's been like, for how many years they've been working? 15 years or so. It's waiting to go up into the temple. And so Zechariah sees a vision in chapter 4 where there are seven eyes. In chapter 3, actually, it blurs into chapter 4. And these eyes are on the stone. Well, they're not in the stone. They're on the stone. And the eyes are looking at the stone as he sees it. And they're waiting for the day in which that stone will go up and the capstone will be there with shouts of grace, grace to it in Zechariah chapter 4. And he's promised that when that happens, Zerubbabel, you will be here. So it's not going to be some time way in the future. Now, what came out of this is that these angels are so excited. In fact, he actually says in Zechariah 4, he says, these seven, they're excited to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel, and they can't wait to see this temple finished. And sometimes we go home a bit discouraged and thinking, well, it is a day of small things sometimes. Maybe we don't have the resources people had before. Maybe economically we don't have those kind of resources, or ecclesially, or in our families. But the angels are there to help us, and they're working in our families and our ecclesias, and they are excited about their work. They want us to work with our kids. They want us to go home and work in our ecclesias. And they will be there to help us every day, 24/7, 365. And it's just fun to watch. This is what Zechariah and Haggai brought to the table that then the people you saw in the reading today, when Zechariah and Haggai were helping them, they stirred the people up and they got working. Even when the governor at that point on the other side of the river, he gets together some of the Samaritans and they go around and they say, what are you guys doing? And they go around and they start collecting names. What is your name? We're going to send your name to the king. What is your name? We're going to send that to the king. And they tried their little intimidation tactics. And they sent to the king and said, you know, these Jews are building this. And isn't it fun to see that the angels orchestrated the events so that when the Jews responded and said to the king, look, we have permission to do this, they searched in the records and they found the decree of Cyrus. Not in the capital city, they found it in Ecbatana, in the summer residence of the Persian kings and up in the higher countries where it was cooler. But they made sure they found a record, and then they said, look it, you got permission, you can finish this temple, and all you guys that caused all this trouble to the Jews, you can pay for it. And it's like what Paul would say, that God is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think. And that's what we have to go home convinced, that God's able to do that in our lives. And you see this running through this whole story right here in the Ezra Nehemiah period. In fact, even at the end of chapter 6, you know, I don't know whether you noticed today, but those are still good points. Is that our takeaways? Yeah, somebody's getting ready to take them away. So at the end of chapter 6, I always found it was fun to notice. I don't know whether you caught on to that, but did you notice that when they finally celebrated, and it talks about it in verse 21, the children of Israel who had returned from the captivity ate together with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek Yahweh, the God of Israel. So who's doing that? These people, because of their motivation and their excitement of getting God's work done and their trust in God to accomplish this, they had an impact on the Gentile nations around them, as the prophets had predicted in the final days when Christ comes back. This was like a foreshadowing of what was going to happen in the kingdom age, when the Gentiles were going to be drawn to Israel. And God was doing this. These were Gentiles who had separated themselves from the filth of the land, and they came to seek the Lord, the God of Israel. And it's a reminder to us that in our families, in our ecclesias, when we go home, when we do trust God and He works things out in our families and our ecclesias, and we move forward with positive things, not the negatives, and the positives, and we know and understand that it's worth it. It's worth moving forward in positives. Whatever it takes to move forward, that our friends and our neighbors can be drawn to that, because they start to see, well, wow, you know, your family's doing pretty good. We used to have people say that to us about our kids, that how come your kids are so well behaved? And they'd wonder, and we get an opportunity to talk to them. Well, it's because we do the Bible readings at home. We go to Sunday school. It's the influence of God in their life. And that's what these people were seeing here. And Gentiles were being drawn to the community. So then Ezra shows up in chapter 7. Ezra decides, and I really do believe that these kings here are just given different names between Darius and Artaxerxes. I personally think they were probably the same king, just different titles like we would use, a president and prime minister or whatever you want to call your leader here. And so in chapter 7, you're getting a different record now, and Ezra is finally going to come back. And as soon as the temple's finished in the sixth year of Darius, then Ezra shows up in the seventh year, because he's just been waiting to show up and work in this temple. And you notice about Ezra, what it talks about him in the readings for tomorrow, in Ezra chapter 7 at verse 10. Notice how when Ezra comes to do his job, he's like us this weekend in verse 10. For Ezra had prepared his heart to teach the law of the Lord, and to do it, to seek the law of the Lord rather, and to do it, and to teach his statutes and ordinances in Israel. And this is a critical component of being an effective worker in our families and ecclesias. We have to set our hearts to seek God's law. We have to be doing our Bible studies in our homes. We have to be searching through the Bible, looking for the answers that we need in order to be an effective worker in our family, a good husband, a good father to our children, and an effective servant in ecclesial life. And then he's committed to do it himself, and then he can become an effective teacher. And you notice the sequence. You first do the work, you prepare, and then you personally put it into practice, and then you can become an effective teacher. I mean, really, honestly, you know, what good is it for me to come here this weekend and talk to you about family life if you get reports about my family that, you know, Jim goes home and, you know, he argues with his wife, you know, and he doesn't have a good relationship with his kids. And if we're not putting these things into practice in our own families, we aren't effective teachers. This is really important. Our kids pick this up right away. If our kids see us argue with our wives, and that's what we do in our homes, they see us argue in the ecclesia, they watch all that and they figure, wow, if that's the way Dad is, then Dad's really not following the Bible. And so when he says all these other things at home, it really doesn't impress him. Really doesn't change his life. And our kids are watching to see, how are these things impacting our lives? I think I grew up in a very sheltered family. And when I grew up as a child, my dad and mom, I never ever saw them argue. Not once. I never saw my dad ever raise his voice to my mom. And I thought that's what everybody else had. Till I, you know, went and visited other people's homes and got to see other things that were happening. But I know in our family that made a huge impact on us. We saw an example in our nuclear family of how mom and dad can get along. And it really did impact, you know, our lives in terms of like how we raise our own kids. And you're just thankful later on you have an opportunity to witness that. But that's what our kids are looking for. It's no good to go home and think we're going to implement these things and we're going to do things that we now suggest about our kids. We're going to start doing the Bible readings at home and we're going to start making these changes, and then we don't really behave in such a way that this is having an impact on our life. They are going to be much more impressed by how we act than what we say. And I think really we all know that. Kids are always watching about how do we act. It's not so much what we say, but how do we act? How do we treat other people? How do we treat our wives? How do we treat our parents? How do we treat ecclesial members? And that goes a lot further than anything that we say about them. And that's what they're looking for. And that's really the kind of things we should be picking out of the Bible readings. So in Ezra, when he finally gets back, in Ezra chapter 7 and 8, and he finally makes the journey to come back, I think what we have left on record for us is a great model for how to handle ecclesial problems. And I think this is what, when I read the scriptures, this is what I look for in terms of, like, you know, handling ecclesial situations today. So you go to Acts 15, or you go to Joshua, or you go to Ezra in this case. Ezra gets back, and he finds out in chapter 9, when he comes back to work in this temple, here he is all excited, he's coming back to work in the temple, and he finally got a few the Levites to come along, and he gets his priests, and he thinks he's ready to go. And he gets back in chapter 9, and it finds that the leaders come to him, and they say, look, we got a problem. The people of Israel, and the priests, and the Levites, not just the people, but the priests and the Levites, have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with respect to the abominations of the Canaanites and so on. They've taken some of their wives and their daughters, you know, and this became a problem, so that the holy seed in this case has intermingled with the peoples of the lands. And they're thinking, wait a minute, why did we go into captivity in the first place? Because we had intermingled with the peoples of the lands, and God looked at our community and said, you're no better than the Canaanites that were here before. You're worse. And he pulled us out of the land. And so Ezra, this is like a shocker to him. He gets home and finds out, now I got to deal with this. You know, and he wasn't coming back thinking that at all. But you watch what happens and how Ezra handles the problem. And I think what you're getting is a model about how do we deal with problems in ecclesial life, which is one of the things we want to go home as leaders in our families and ecclesias. And you want to know, like, what do we do? And you're going to have problems. So what do you do when the problems arise? So you find that what he does in chapter 9 is he shows the people how concerned he is. He personally becomes involved in the concern of the problem, not just by yelling at everybody, but he tears out his hair, he rips his clothes, and he actually sits there and fasts, you know, and he is involved in this problem. It's not your problem, it's my problem. I'm involved too. And this is how you become an effective leader in solving these problems. So then you see what he does as a result of this. People are drawn to him in verse 4. Then everyone who trembled at the words of the God of Israel, they assembled him, you know, at this point because of the transgressions of those who had been carried away captive. Right? So he gathers people together to become involved in the problem. And then his solution at the time of the evening sacrifice, he falls on his knees, spreads out his hands to God, and prays to God. And he doesn't pray about them. He prays about us. We have a problem. We and our iniquities. This is how you become an effective worker in ecclesial life. It isn't their problem. It's our problem that we need to solve. And he lays it out before God, admitting that, you know, we have our iniquities, he says in verse 6 there, you know, and our guilt is grown up to the heavens. And he admits the fact that we all have a problem. And then Ezra looks for, you know, in a solution. And as he's doing this and praying, then a whole bigger group of people. So now more people are being drawn to him, because he doesn't come in with this authoritative kind of thing of, you have a problem, you have that. Instead, he says, we all have a problem and we need to seek a solution. So now a whole bunch of people come in and he's drawn them all in. And then what happens is that you might think that of all times, this would be a great opportunity for Ezra to stand up and say, all right, because, you know, we have this problem and we've prayed to God now, I've got a solution. I know what we should do. You know, he's the man who's prepared his heart to seek the Lord and to do it and to teach. He doesn't do that. Ezra sits there, draws all these people together, And he doesn't come to the meeting thinking, I've got the answer and we've got to do my solution. Instead, what he does is he takes this approach of waiting for the solution to come from the group, which I find fascinating in terms of like effective models for like working in families in ecclesial life. So he's waiting. He gets all these people together. And in chapter 10 then, what you find is that while he was praying and weeping, all right, all these people, a very large congregation comes. And then you have Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam. He spoke up and said to Ezra, "We have transgressed against our God and taken pagan wives from the peoples of the land." Now, you find out later on that this fellow, Shechaniah, his dad, Jehiel, was one of the ones who had a pagan wife. So this guy's family is involved personally in this, and here he is looking to help out in the solution. But he says, look, you know, we've made these mistakes. So we have. We've done errors, and we're all going to do that in family life and ecclesia. We've made some mistakes, but what you have to do is move forward. We have to find a way to move forward out of our mistakes. So we acknowledge our mistakes, and we say, all right, here's a suggestion. So now in verse 3, let us make a covenant with our God, the God, to put away these wives and those who've taken them, that have been born to them, the kids and so on, according to the counsel of my master, and those who trembled at the commandment of the Lord our God, and let it be done according to the law. So they probably went according to the law in terms of like writing bills of divorce and so on in this case, because they were going to split up these families. So he comes up with a solution. And then the group says, all right, this sounds like a good idea. It's almost like the divine counsel, the way God works when he gets the angels together in 2 Kings 22. And he says, all right, here's the plan today. Ahab needs to fall at Ramoth and Gilead. Anybody have any ideas about how we can get that done? And one spirit comes forward and says this. Another one comes forward and says that. And finally, one of the angels gets up and says, I'll be a lying spirit in the mouth of his prophets. God says, good idea. Go do that. See, that's the way groups work. They come together. Nobody has all the answers to start with. They get together, they discuss, and solutions come from the group in order to move forward. And it really is a more effective way to run ecclesias and families and so on. But you have to have the confidence that God is working. So you don't have to walk into the group and say, well, I've got to do all the research ahead of time. I've got to figure out all the answers. And I've got to come to the group and make sure they do it my way. And we have brethren sometimes like that. And they're not effective ecclesial leaders. Because you might have a great answer. But if you can't convince the people to buy into the answer, what good is it? The part of the solution is that everyone is involved and they're committed, which is what Ezra got in the end. You know, the people were committed. So what they do then is, you know, we might think that the solution was simply, in reading this, you'd think, all right, it was simple. You just go through the whole community and you find out who married a pagan wife, all of you split up and all your kids sent them away. And that's the way we might read that. You know, they spent 90 days, 3 months, mandating everybody come in. They sat down with them, probably one at a time, and probably talked to them and said, all right, you've married a pagan wife. What is your family going to do now at this point? You have to make a decision. You're either going to split up or your wife has to make a commitment to join the God of Israel and your family and teach your kids Hebrew. What are you going to do? It would have been very easy to just pass legislation and say, everybody who did it is cut off. That isn't what happened here. They spent 3 months categorizing them, accumulating lists, and in the end, only 113 cases actually were forced to split, of which almost 25% of those were priests and Levites. So the original report that this problem is amongst the leaders was true. And in this case, there's a good chunk of them that in this case had to split up from their wives. But I think it's a great model for just like patiently going through situations, talking to people, trying to resolve a problem in a patient, calm way without just immediately passing legislation and implementing rules and thinking, well, that's going to solve our problems. And these are great models in the Bible that have been left on record for us, brethren and sisters, when we go home in order to solve some of our ecclesial problems. So, you know, I leave that with you over the next few days as you're reading the rest of Ezra. Just look at that carefully, and I find that that whole situation is amazing about, you know, how they dealt with an ecclesial problem. And we will have to when we go home. We're going to have family issues we have to deal with. You're going to have ecclesial problems. You have ongoing situations right now in Ontario that ecclesias have to deal with. So you look for Bible models about how did they do it back then. We're not the first ones that run into trouble. How did they solve these problems? How did they come up with solutions? And then we try to mimic those things when we move forward with the help of our God. So this morning, then, as we go to take the emblems, you know, all weekend long we have talked about ways that we can be more effective in our families as dads, as fathers, and as husbands, and then effective servants in ecclesial life. And we've been left with us to remember this morning the man who gave all. He didn't hold anything back because he trusted what God was doing in his life entirely and believed that if he followed God's plan, that God would save him. And the way he did it, the way he's presented in the scriptures, is that his motive every day in life wasn't to like, what do I need to do today to make sure that I get saved and I don't sin and I don't make any mistakes. What he did is he went out and he served. He served other people. He helped other people. He was compassionate and kind and merciful like his God. And in the midst of doing that, that is the mechanism that God used to save him. And it won't be any different for us, brothers and sisters. The key is that we have to trust God. We've got to trust that whatever he brings into our life, he's using it for our good so that one day we can share his holiness. So as we take the emblems this morning and as we prepare to go on home, let's go home with the confidence that God will help us this next week to implement some of these things we've talked about. He really does want success. The angels would like nothing better than for us to go home and find success in some of the things that we've talked about. They want to help us in finding success in our families and in our ecclesias. And let's be courageous. You know, go home this, as you're going home, think about, you know, make yourself a list, whatever it takes of here are some of the five things that maybe I can change, maybe I'm going to work on, and take them one at a time. Just deal with one thing next week and try to improve in one area. Then later on, when you feel comfortable with that, go down to item two and start working on that. And if item one doesn't work out real well, don't give up. Just drop down and try two instead. And that's the way life has to go sometimes. It doesn't always work the way we thought it might work. But let's go home with some confidence and assurance that our God is with us. He's going to help us in our times of need. And what a great high priest we have who's been willing to show us the way of service to our Heavenly Father and to each other, that in the end, that service is the very thing that God will use to save our souls. Thanks.